whatever. The first question is the reading quiz. The second question is the attendance part. So just do the best you can to reproduce your description.
Yeah, question? Two copies of...
Oh, sorry, stuck together.
Okay, so if you take the quizzes, please, and you flip them face down and pass them down to the end, we'll go ahead and collect those. They're the...
Okay, just a couple of quick announcements. We have now returned everything we're going to on your midterm papers. So if you got two proofread markup paper copies of your midterm paper back, that's it. You can start rewriting. If you only got one copy of your midterm paper back, that's it. You can start rewriting. So if you got two, your grade is the average of the two. If you got one, that's your grade. If you don't have anything else, we're done. Any questions? We'll do a week from today. Anything else?
Okay.
Syllabus is the law. The syllabus is the law.
We don't want to get sued.
Whatever the syllabus says, that's what we do.
Okay.
Whatever word came out of my mouth, doesn't matter. Whatever the syllabus says, that's what
we do. The extra week puts us into Thanksgiving, so it doesn't really work. Right. So.
Yeah.
Besides, I thought it was November 6th, and it's actually November 16th. That's why I thought there might be a need for an extra week, but there wasn't. So. Okay.
And then a brief comment about this. So for the last three lectures, we've been telling you about radiation, and in particular, a non-ionizing, non-fatal, non-harmful radiation from cell phones. But cell phones can hurt you quite badly. So let me see a show of hands. You can be honest. How many people talk on the cell phone while driving?
Please raise your hand as closely to the microphone as you can. Excellent.
Okay.
Well, for synesthesia.
A lot of you. Don't do that, please. The NTSB, National Traffic Safety Board, did an experiment, like the Mythbusters, though a little bit more rigorous. Talking on a cell phone increases your chances of having a traffic accident by a factor of 4. It is the same odds ratio as if you were drunk. So talking on a cell phone is like driving drunk. You're putting yourself at risk. More importantly, you're putting me at risk because I'm out there on the road when you're driving. Okay, so don't talk and drive. Yes? Excellent question. That's where I was
going. That's an outstanding question.
Yep. Hands-free or hands-full doesn't matter. It's not your hands. It's your attention. When you're talking on the cell phone, you get tunnel vision. You don't notice what's going on around you. Isn't it the same as listening to the radio? No, because you don't have to talk back and forth to the radio. You can ignore the radio if something more important comes up. Isn't it like talking to a passenger in the car? No, because the passenger knows when to shut up.
And you probably have lots of passengers that are like, no, don't do that. Turn left here. Slow down.
Anyone in particular, me.
No. That's on tape, so my spouse can play that over and over and over again.
When you have passengers in the car, you have at least two sets of eyes looking around if they can see things that you can't. It's actually safer to drive with a passenger, even if you're talking to a passenger. It's safer to drive with a passenger than to drive alone.
And that's why all parents should let all teenagers have friends in the car after they're about 30. I'm not a parent, so I get to say that.
One more honesty poll here. How many people text and drive at the same time?
Oh, man, today the truth is out, my friend.
Please stop doing that. Okay? When you text and drive at the same time, you increase your risk by a factor of 27. It's like driving drunk and on cocaine.
And with your eyeballs plucked out, because you might as well at that point, you're not looking at the road. So
you think you can multitask? You can't. You can only switch back and forth really quickly. And for driving, that's a real problem.
Right. Okay, so I'm going to tell you how this class is going to end today. One of us is going to overdose on sleeping pills, and the other one is not. So keep that in mind, okay? So in the spirit of a nice cliffhanger at the beginning of today's episode of CFB 3333, what we're going to do is we're going to start alternative medicine, and we're going to start with homeopathy. And homeopathy is nice because it's an easy way to introduce a very fundamental underlying concept that you need to understand in the medical community, and that is the placebo effect. Okay. So, without necessarily knowing what that word means, if you know what that word means, would you please raise your hand if you know you've ever been given a placebo? And? Can you talk about it? What was it? Okay. So that it was an anxiety-reducing technique. Okay, and just out of curiosity, the person who gave it to you, what were they? Your mother, okay. Wearing a lab coat, no lab coat? Is she a medical professional of any kind?
No.
Oh, wow, okay. Excellent. Okay, so she had a prescription bottle full of pills that she said would relieve your anxiety so that you could go and get a shot. Okay, anyone else?
Did it work?
Did it work?
No.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, you're one of the 80% of people that don't fall for that, then.
When did you figure out it was a placebo?
Later.
Oh, so it could have had a possibility of working.
Right. Okay, so that, but basically an authoritative figure gave it to you and said this would help. Okay. Another one? Yeah?
I don't know if it counts, but...
It probably doesn't if you have to say that. No, go ahead.
I was doing a commercial for a food or whatever, and I was doing a breathing treatment, but there's no medicine.
Okay, but there was no medical condition for which you were being treated. Okay.
Well, I'm supposed to be a patient.
Right. But in fact, there are placebo inhalers that contain nothing but an inert ingredient that can be given to people in case you want to check and see whether or not they're just having an anxiety-related breathing problem or a real breathing problem. It's a diagnostic tool. So you probably use the same thing that other people use. Yeah. Okay, so there are, in fact, inhaler placebo.
But here's the difference. You knew that ahead of time,
right?
Yeah.
You knew it had zero chance. If you know it's a placebo, ahead of time, it's not going to work,
right?
You have to buy into it.
Yeah. Degree of belief dictates the power of the placebo effect, right? So let me go into that a little bit. What is placebo? Placebo is a Latin word, okay? And it means I shall please. So it is a ingredient given to a patient purely with the intention of pleasing them, but with no actual medicinal benefit. It doesn't actually contain an active ingredient which goes and treats the underlying known cause of a claimed disorder, disease, dysfunction, something like that. Okay, so anxiety is a good example where there could be biological reasons why you're suffering from anxiety, or they might be purely psychological, and if you're purely psychological, you can check for that by trying a placebo test on somebody to see how they respond to it. Okay. So for Martin Edwards' piece, Placebo in the Lancet, which is a big medical journal in Britain, right, there's a very nice little one-column description of sort of the history of this. He's a scientist, medical historian. And so basically, placebo entered English, as we know it now, in the 13th century, but it didn't appear in medical parlance until the late 18th century, so the late 1700s. Hooper's Medical Dictionary of 1811, and I actually find that to be an interesting date, 1811, keep that in mind, okay, defined the term as any medicine adapted more to please than benefit the patient. Okay. Now, placebo, as adjusted, can be a useful diagnostic tool. So, for instance, doctors making house calls, they have a bag with a limited number of things they can carry in it. So what things would they typically carry in their bag to make house calls?
You're not old enough to remember. When I was a kid, doctors came to the house. They brought a little bag. They had a stethoscope, tongue depressor, and you can't bring the whole pharmacy with you. They had aspirin, laxatives, and a little tiny sugar pill. And the sugar pill was the smallest one of all, and the doctor would hand it to you. Didn't need the aspirin or the laxatives, the doctor would hand me the little pill and said, these are really strong. I can't even give you two. I can only give you one. Take this, call me in the morning, see if it gets better.
Right.
And he would really sell it to you.
Right. Now,
nothing in there.
Is there an ethical issue there? And if so, why? And if not, why not? Anyone think there's an ethical issue there?
Yeah, okay. I'm paying for the house call, not necessarily
right.
Okay,
so maybe, yeah, so you had to pay for the house call. Okay, so maybe there's an ethical issue, yeah? Oh, okay, so if it's meningitis, that would be a good example. Okay, meningitis can kill in less than 24 hours. That might be an issue, okay? Meningitis is typically also accompanied by severe flu-like symptoms like fever and things like that. So if you're just having an ache or a pain or something where you can't get out of bed or something like that, it may not be necessarily life-threatening, okay? So I would say people think it's an ethical issue. Okay, but you can look at it also more broadly as part of a diagnostic tool. If you don't actually have a disease, or if it's going to get better within 24 hours anyway, the doctor then doesn't have to drag you into the office and make you pay for an additional visit for something that wasn't even needed in the first place. Whereas if you call back the next morning and say, look, I feel the same or worse than I did yesterday, can I please come in? Yes, please come in. This is clearly something serious. Okay, so that pill didn't do the trick. But the key is the doctor has to sell it.
We should also point out, I mean, if you're bleeding from the ears and the nose, the doctor's not going to give you a sugar pill.
You're going into the hospital.
There's a problem.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Professor Cotton, for instance, wasn't given a sugar pill when he went in to see his doctor about some discomfort he was having. Okay. So, all right. So it can be used as a diagnostic tool, but it can also be used unethically as well. And we'll delve into that a little bit today. So what is the placebo effect? The placebo effect, quite simply, is when the patient responds to this inert non-medical thing as if they had been given real medicine. So they physically and mentally respond to it with all the responses you'd expect from a patient getting better, okay? They feel better, or maybe even the disease clears up on its own and they feel better, okay? So it can have both of those effects. It can be both a mental sensation of, ah, I have medicine now, I feel better, I don't feel so anxious or so sick, or so maybe my fever's coming down, okay? This is a real effect, it's not fake. People really do go through these physical changes when they are sold on the fact that they're, first of all, being given a real medicine, and second of all, are susceptible to that belief, okay? Its power comes ultimately, though, from belief and expectation that the placebo is real medicine. The minute that the curtain is pulled and the truth is revealed, it no longer has the effect anymore, because you know you've been duped, because you don't believe it anymore. And so you have no expectation anymore that you should be getting better or feeling better. These effects can vary. It can affect as many as 100% of people in a group, and more typically, it's sort of 20 to 30% of people in a group.
Yeah, I have a little personal anecdote here. I watched my aunt get absolutely loopy drunk on non-alcoholic champagne because she thought it was champagne.
Okay, so that's an excellent placebo. Actually, in that case, I guess that would be a nocebo effect. Because you have a negative response to something that is, in fact, completely inert. Well, okay, she was happy. If she was vomiting later, maybe it wasn't so great. Okay, all right. I'm not sure that anyone really knows the specific reasons for it. I mean, certainly an aspect of it is conditioning. So, for instance, you can condition an animal to respond in a way similar to the placebo effect. You can have two food bowls, right? And you can make it so that when they go to one food bowl, electric shock. So they associate pain with that food bowl, but if they eat from the other one, it's fine. You condition them, then you take the second food bowl away. So now they have to eat from the first one, but they've been conditioned to believe that it's dangerous. Okay. Even if you take the shock away. Right. So they might respond more negatively, assuming that the negative effects are going to happen to them as well. For instance. Okay. Okay, yeah, so it's probably a mixture of a number of things. There's certainly a real physical response, but there's mental conditioning to it as well.
I thought you were asking about different cultures, because every culture has this.
Yeah.
Like there are witch doctors, there are shamans. Every culture has a doctor-like figure. And some things they do really have a physical effect,
right?
Chemical effect. Some don't. Sometimes it's just a dance, sometimes it's a touch on the head,
right?
All those are placebo, and it is cultural. It's whatever you expect the doctor.
And I'll delve into that in a bit as well as an example. But yeah, Misha. Yes, but no one's going to believe that Raza is not a shill, so we're getting to that. Actually, while I'm thinking of it, so with the person in the fifth row, second seat, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, second person over,
would you verify that that bottle is sealed and that it hasn't been obviously tampered with? Please, you can hang on to that until we need it, okay?
I just want you to verify the bottle hasn't been opened, okay?
In fact, let your neighbor see it.
Yeah, let your neighbor see. Sure, don't open it. Do not open it yet, okay? All right, so let's talk about the cultural effects, okay? Because placebo is a cultural, psychological, at least in part, phenomenon. If your culture has conditioned you to believe certain things, then you will respond in a way consistent with that conditioning. So here are some examples, okay? So Crane et al., in their article on placebo effect in the treatment of duodenal ulcers, okay, so those are ulcers that affect the duodenum is the opening that goes from the stomach to the esophagus. Am I right or wrong about that? I'm right? Okay, I'm getting one pre-med. You're nodding. Okay, good. Stomach to the intestines?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay, all right. The nice thing about ulcers is you can stick a camera down somebody's throat and actually measure them, right? So these are measurable things, which is what makes them very nice for placebo studies. And what these researchers found is that patients that got 4 placebo interventions, so 4 pills, basically, inert, okay, sugar pills, got those every day for 4 weeks, okay, they recovered at a rate of 44.2%, while those getting 2 pills every day for 4 weeks recovered at a lower rate of 36%, okay, so it's in absolute terms, that's an 8% difference between them, But in relative terms, we're talking about a 22% increase in recovery rate when you're given four placebo pills a day for 4 weeks rather than two. Why? Because you believe that four is a more invasive procedure than two, that you're getting more medicine and your expectation is you should be healing faster. Okay? Here's another one. This is expectations based on colors. In our society, we often associate things like red with aggressive or negative connotations, and blue with more calming and soothing connotations. Okay, that's a cultural thing. So what these researchers found, and they published their results in The Lancet in 1972, is when they took a bunch of U.S. medical students, and they gave them randomly either a red pill or a blue pill, and the group was told as a whole that one of these is a stimulant and one of them is a depressant, and they should report their reactions to it and then decide whether the red pill or the blue pill is the stimulant or the depressant. Now, they didn't know, but both of them were placebo. Neither of them had any active ingredients whatsoever in them. But overwhelmingly, these U.S. participants, these med students, labeled the red one as the stimulant and the blue is the depressant. This was repeated in Denmark, where they also coincidentally happened to associate warmer colors like reds and oranges and yellows with stimulating ideas, and cooler colors like greens and blues with soothing ideas. And so that result was independently confirmed under that cultural conditioning situation in Denmark as well. Okay, again, all inert. No active ingredients, no actual stimulant, no actual depressant in any of these pills. No, surprisingly, I'm going to lay off the Matrix jokes today. And you can imagine what faculty meetings are like. All right, so if you want more resources on this, because there's just a lot of studies that have been published about this, David Merman actually does a very nice job of going through them and stepping through them from a cultural perspective. And you can find this, the actual text of this this reference, available through snu.edu/cul. So if you search for this through that engine, we have access to the electronic copy of that. You can read it. So yeah, Rosa.
Do you know of any studies that have been done to
I don't know. That's a good question. Something to delve into for a research paper, for instance, for anyone who still hasn't picked a topic, I guess, at the last minute here. Okay. No, I mean, presumably there is a neurochemical basis for these things, but I'm not sure that that's at all established as to what the link is and how you would control it, for instance. Okay. Right now, in a medical study, because the placebo effect has been demonstrated not only time and time again to be real, but its degree of severity varies with your perception and expectation of the outcome. Is the person wearing a lab coat or not who gives you the sugar pill that you don't know is a sugar pill? Is it an injection or is it a pill? An injection is expected to be a much more invasive and therefore much more useful treatment than a pill. Two sugar pills are better than one sugar pill. We kind of saw that demonstrated with the ulcer study. Okay, your expectations have to be carefully understood in the context of a medical study. Because if the people giving out the real drug are dressed in ripped t-shirts and jeans, and the people handing out the placebo are dressed in white lab coats and ties with pocket protectors and glasses and all kinds of, they look very serious with clipboards, that will condition you to actually respond potentially more favorably to the placebo than the actual drug, and that can blur the results of the drug test itself. Okay, so researchers doing medical research need to truly deeply understand the placebo effect to make any sense of a new medication. And you always want to test a new medication not only against placebo, which is essentially testing it against nothing, okay, but you want to test it against the best medication on the market given at the recommended dose. And there's lots of ways to play with that and mess with that. And drug companies often perform outstanding quality experimental studies of drugs, but they fudge the doses. They put them at the high end or the low end of the acceptable rate to make their pill look better or have less side effects, things like that. Ben Goldacre is an epidemiologist. He has a great TED talk where he surveys in about 20 minutes all of these topics. It's very punchy, it's very lively. I don't know if I've shown you any of this already, but it's linked off here and you can find it on the web. So, okay. All right, so let me now, you've got the placebo effect in mind. You can be conditioned to believe, based on your expectation of outcome, that you're actually receiving a medication and respond in a favorable way as a result. So let me talk about what homeopathy is. Homeopathy originated from a German physician named Samuel Hahnemann in 1810. Now remember that medical dictionary where placebo was really first formally defined appeared in 1811. I'm sure that's a coincidence, but I find it a fascinating numerical coincidence nonetheless. Okay? And homeopathy is based on two essentially core claims. Okay? The first claim is that like cures like. So if you can be given a poison that induces the same symptoms as a disease that's ravaging your community. A homeopath believes that by giving you a low dose, and we'll talk about how low in a bit, but a low dose of the poison, that will cure the actual disease that's ravaging the community. Like cures like. Something that induces the same symptoms in a person, okay? So imagine that there's a fever going around that involves swelling of the limbs or things like that. If you're stung by a bee and you have an allergic reaction to bee venom, you may also get a fever and swell in the limbs as a result. So maybe a low dose of bee venom will cure that. That's the claimed premise of homeopathy. That's one of them, okay? So without regard at all to what the cause of the disease is, like cures like, that's the claim, okay? Yeah, go for it.
Ottoman, at that time, a lot of countries, colonies in the tropics, and the people who worked in the tropics, harvested the sugar and the spices and everything, were getting malaria. A local cure was found. There's a tree called a cinchona tree, and you strip off the bark and boil it and extract the chemical. That chemical is quinine. And if you give quinine to somebody who has malaria, it will alleviate the symptoms. If you give it to someone before they get malaria, it will prevent them from severe symptoms. So Hahnemann, being a physician, had access to that powder, the quinine powder. He overdosed on it. He intentionally took a lot of quinine, and he noticed that he got very pale, he started to sweat profusely, and he started to shake. He said, well, that's interesting. Those are exactly the symptoms of malaria. The drug that cures malaria, treats malaria, he said, the drug that treats malaria induces the same symptoms as the disease. That's how he came up with life.
Now, there's nothing wrong with this, because the germ theory of disease really wasn't cemented as a useful claim of disease in human beings or any other species for that matter until the late 1800s, although there was an earlier demonstration of the potential for solving problems related to medical issues, and I'll talk about that in a moment. Okay. Yeah, so that's good. I mean, so he made an observation, and then from that he formulated his claim. It's a hypothesis, and it can be tested. Okay, that's the key. This hypothesis can be tested. If life does cure life, we should be able, under rigorous conditions, give a homeopathic medication, a placebo, and maybe a real medication that we know, based on the germ theory of disease, cures the underlying cause, and compare them. Okay? We'll do that in a moment. Yeah, question. Yeah. Vaccines give you a small amount either of the dead virus to prime your immune system, or of the lethal factors that are part of the disease process that cause an immune response. So, for instance, the whooping cough vaccine that's having problems right now with maybe longevity being an issue, that's based on a component of the virus, but not the dead virus like it used to be. So, yes, but that is a medically detectable dose. And you'll see why this is not the same as a vaccine in a moment.
And the cover, the outside needs to look the same.
That's right. If you're going to do a control test on a pill, everything has to look identical. The same people dressed the same way have to give the placebo, the homeopathic medication, and the real medication.
In fact,
for the
people giving you the pill can't know.
And they can't know, because they can give you cues. So that's important. That's why double-blind, randomized controlled trials are the essence of any good medical investigation, period. Because we all give away information without knowing it, okay? Even if we're trying really hard not to. All right? Now, okay, related to this issue here about vaccination, for instance, there's another claim that goes with homeopathy, and that is that potency of homeopathic medication is achieved by diluting the active ingredient. The more dilute, so goes the homeopathic linguistic trick, the more potent it is. So the more you dilute something, the more homeopathically potent it is. Okay.
That sounds
fine,
everyone.
Yeah. Does that sound weird?
When you're brushing your teeth, you got a mouthful of minty toothpaste. How do you get rid of it? Rinse, right? Does it get stronger? No. So this is outside of everyday experience.
Yeah, and also the fundamental operating principles of chemistry, biology, and physics. But we'll get to that in a bit.
Okay.
No, it doesn't matter. All right. So let me take a little historical aside here. Cholera. Cholera is as relevant now as it was back then, although at least we have a germ theory of disease-related solution to it at this point. People, for instance, in London did not have the operating principles of the germ theory of disease to work with when there were outbreaks of cholera, which originated in the regions of the Ganges originally and has migrated across the whole world now. they didn't have an operating theory as to how to treat people. So when, for instance, just as a note, homeopathy was proposed in 1810, as we said, germ theory of disease was first really practically demonstrated by a man named John Snow in the Soho London cholera outbreak of 1854. We have a whole page on this if you want to look at it, but the bottom line is that he was the one that had proposed that basically water supplies were becoming contaminated, and he was able to show that a sewage leak into a water supply in Soho, London, correlated strongly with the radius of affected people, and where the leak was not present in an independent water supply, people were much less affected as a result. This was one of the first major triumphs of the germ theory of disease, but it really didn't come into its full until later that century. Okay, what you need to know is that the common treatments for many things, but cholera included, were often dangerous to the patients at the time. So standard conventional medical practice involved things like bloodletting, where you would excise the patient and bleed them a certain amount to get the bad blood out. Okay, what does this do to a person who's already weakened with illness? Makes it worse. Now you're compromising that person's ability to fight infection, and you're also weakening them by draining their blood supply. Mortality rate from cholera was 50 to 60% in conventional hospitals, okay, in the 1831 cholera outbreak. That's horrific. Homeopathic hospitals, which had come into being at that point, claimed a lower mortality rate of about 20%. Okay. Now, that sounds pretty astounding. That's why people were convinced that maybe there was something to homeopathy, but there are, of course, many rival causes as to why that might be. First of all, the homeopaths are not bleeding their patients. They're probably also not as widely used hospitals and not as filthy. Controlling, you know, dirt and filth and disease and blood and feces and all that other stuff that piles up in a hospital during a cholera outbreak, that was sort of vaguely understood at the time as something you ought to do to protect other patients. But if you have fewer patients, you're at less risk of cross-contaminating patients with more cholera. Now, what you need to do, of course, is compare these things to modern oral rehydration and antibiotic treatments, which are based on the germ theory of disease, treating the underlying cause. You need to get electrolytes back into the person. You need to rehydrate them. Most people can recover from cholera on their own, and for the extreme cases, they need antibiotics. Those treatments have a less than 1% mortality rate. And the majority of cases in that 1% are people that are already compromised in some way. Even if they receive the treatment, they're unlikely to recover. Okay. So another thing you need to know is that Samuel Hahnemann coined a term. And that term is still in conventional use these days. And that term has a very logically fallacious application. Okay. So he wanted to make a distinction between what he was proposing and conventional medicine, which was pretty nasty back then. It wasn't based on the germ theory of disease. Okay, so he coined homeopathy, but he also coined allopathy. And allopathy is everything else that's conventional. Now, there's a reason you would do this, and a reason people use this in the modern era is to make it sound, even after 100 years of the germ theory of disease in full operation, makes it sound as though homeopathy and conventional medicine are somehow on level playing field. That you have this and you have this alternative, and that they're equal, and no one can disprove that. There's no science that says that allopathy and homeopathy aren't the same, okay? So you're gonna find a lot of people using this term, especially they'll define the debate platform by saying, well, in allopathy, by which they mean scientifically based conventional medicine, okay? So they're just hiding that. They're hiding that from you by saying that. This is a great trick. If you're in a political campaign, what do you wanna do? You wanna label your opponent, okay? You wanna make that label stick. And this, I don't think that necessarily Hahnemann was doing this, because let's face it, conventional medicine was crap back then. It was awful. But nowadays, that's not the case. We're not bloodletting people anymore. All right. So that word is really, that equality is gone, and you'll see why. Okay. So who makes the claims today about homeopathy? We're not talking Samuel Hahnemann anymore. He's dead. So lots of people make this claim. Go ahead and go web surfing. You'll have fun. Here's some famous ones, all in one page, as I found last night. So here on Oprah's page, Oprah.com, Oprah Radio, homeopathy, she's got a whole URL for that. Here's Dr. Mehmet Oz, okay, who is a very famous TV physician now. And he peddles all kinds of things. Now, he does peddle legitimate scientifically based medicine, but he sprinkles in all these non-scientifically based medicines all over the place. And by talking about them, he gives them his seal of approval, okay? So here he is, for instance, with the author of a book called The Homeopathic Revolution, Why Famous People and Cultural Heroes Choose Homeopathy. I really don't give a damn whether famous people or cultural heroes choose it. I care what the science says, because I don't want to die, okay? So what do homeopathic medications look like? Somebody's holding one right there. Here's an example from the CVS Pharmacy website. Okay, you can go and search on. Now, you often won't find these physically in store. Many of the stores like CVS and Walgreens have removed their homeopathy section. And pharmacists are largely relieved by this because they think it's crap and they're happy the store isn't selling it anymore. You actually heard this, right? Yeah.
I used to be able to go to Walmart and buy the thing that we were going to show you today, the thing we're going to try to overdose on. And I went in there once and they stopped selling it. So I went to the pharmacist who had a PhD in pharmacy. And I asked her, where can I get this homeopathic kidney pill? And she said, and I quote, "We don't sell that crap anymore." Good for you.
I still need a bottle of it, though. Yeah, right.
And she suggested, go to Whole Foods. And she was right, boy. There's a thousand remedies.
In fact, I went to Whole Foods last night looking for ibuprofen for the tendonitis in my right arm that I've now developed. And for that stuff, I could not find ibuprofen. We had to go someplace else to get that. CVS, actually. All right. So if you go to CVS's website, this sleep relief, homeostasis lab sleep relief homeopathic medicine is $9.99. Okay, this is for 50 tablets, and it weighs 0.06 pounds. Okay. Now, I checked. This was from the spring. As of November 8th, 2012, the price has now dropped to $7.99, so it's a bargain. Right? Now, obtained from the CVS pharmacy website, that's where I got this, April 30th, 2012. Homeopathic medicine is available for purchase greater than 100 years after the cause of the disease is actually revealed. Okay. Now, by comparison, 50 tablets of Tylenol PM, which I do use to try to force myself to go to sleep on a plane when I go to CERN, because I can't sleep on planes otherwise, that's $8 at Walmart. That price has actually dropped. So now you can pay $7.99 for this stuff, or you can pay $7.99 for a sleep aid at Walmart that actually puts you to sleep. Now, I want you to look, I'll talk about this in a moment, but I want you to look at the ingredients, okay? Active ingredients in this stuff. Arsenicum album, Coffea cruda, Nitricum acidum, okay? All right, so you keep looking here. It sounds like something out of, like, The Life of Brian, if anyone's seen that movie. And I'm not going to repeat what the joke is in that movie, but you can go watch it and you'll find out what I mean, okay? It sounds very Latin, very medicine-y, right? Why don't you explain where these come from? Where are these things that we're seeing?
These are all ingredients from the natural world. These are milkweed sap, these are ground up honeybees, white arsenic, which is a deadly poison.
Yep.
But anything in the natural world, this is another fallacy, the naturalistic fallacy. Natural things are good, natural things are bad. Plenty of natural things can kill you. Psilocybin and mushrooms can kill you.
Right.
Maybe callus in the foxglove can kill you. Not everything natural is safe. But that's what Hahnemann had available to him, and there's a large formulary of homeopathic medicine.
It's called the HPUS.
Right. It's all coming out of that book.
Yeah, so you'll see HPUS, that's this formulary that gets referred to. And in fact, there's a cutoff date for, things can't be added to it anymore because it involves testing on people to figure out whether it induces the same symptoms like death as another disease. So it's not really ethical anymore. So that at some point they cut off the HPUS and nothing. I don't think they get added anymore.
There was a senator who wrote the Pure Food and Drug Act that gave life to the FDA. That senator was a homeopath, so he grandfathered in all of these medicines. Anything that was available at that date
in the U.S. in the U.S. Okay. Now let's go back to potency and dilution. All right. Now white arsenic is deadly. And you see there's a number next to this, 30C. This tells you the amount of white arsenic present in the preparation that was used to make the pills. So the homeopathic potency scale is something you need to understand, because this could sound, 30C can sound very impressive, right? One-to-one dilution, that is, you take one part of the arsenic and one part water, and you mix them. This is known as the, one-to-one is undiluted, okay? That's the mother tincture, okay?
That would be this.
That would be that.
The role is being played by blue food dye.
Okay.
This is the mother tincture. If you put a drop of this arsenic on your tongue, you're dead.
Dude, that's it. Mind out. Okay? That's the mother tincture. That stuff will kill you. Now, 1X means that the active ingredient is diluted with distilled water. I don't know if you have distilled water here, but you'll get the idea.
Well, you know it is.
Right. By a ratio of 1 to 10. So 1 part arsenic, 10 parts water. Okay? 2X is when you dilute 1 to 10 again. So you take one part of the first mixture and mix it with 10 parts distilled water.
Hey, slow down a little bit, I'll do it while you're...
Okay.
So there's the mother tincture mixed with 9 parts water. This is a 1X. So
solution, 10% solution. You also have to succuss it, Hahnemann says. You have to shake it against your hand 10 times in the vertical direction. 10 times this way.
That's how I got
10 times. 10 times that way. The three dimensions. Does that make sense? Good. Succuss, you invented the word. Shake it. Shake it up. Then you take the 1x solution and you mix one part 1x solution with 9 parts water. Now you have yourself a 2x solution. So for every molecule of arsenic in here, how many molecules of water are there? Well, let's go here. For how many? For every molecule of arsenic in the 1x solution, how many molecules of water are there?
10. Very good.
How about in the 2x solution? 100. Right, this is 1% solution. A 2x solution is a 1% solution. Don't forget to shake it. Okay, 10 times. And you continue.
Okay. So now, then there's the C scale. And on the C scale, the active ingredient is diluted by a ratio of 1 to 100, okay? So 1C is 1 to 100 dilution. We would need one part of that to 100 parts distilled water. 2C is 1 to 100 again, okay? So that's 1 in 10,000. 12C is 1 in 10 to the 24. Okay, 6.02 times 10 to the 23rd is Avogadro's number. That's roughly the number of molecules of anything in a terrestrially sized container. Okay, so when you get to 12C, there's a less than 50% chance there's even one molecule of the active ingredient left in the volume of water anymore. This one is 30C. 30C means the active ingredient is diluted 1 to 10 to the 60. Okay, and this is referred to as high potency. Okay, remember, more dilution is more potent in homeopathy. Okay? So, how many dilutions have you done here?
I've made 6. So this was the 10% solution, the 1x, this is 2x, 3x, 4x, 5x, 6x. For every molecule of arsenic in here, how many molecules of water are there? 1 million. This is a 1 ppm, 1 part per million solution. I can't even see the blue dye.
And they just keep going, okay?
So, and, yeah, they don't stop at 6.
They don't stop at 6. They keep
you
going.
Need, okay. Bottles.
Yep, we have bottles.
Bottles.
All right, so I went to Whole Foods yesterday. I purchased myself a homeopathic sleep aid. It cost me $10 for 80 pills. The whole bottle and the pills weigh 0.019 pounds. The inactive ingredient in this is sugar. And remember, the dilution has been done with water, and it's a 200C, 200C dilution. That means one part in every 10 to the 400 water molecules. Does anybody know how many atoms there are in the universe? And is? 10 to the 80. Guess how many universes I would need to find one molecule, and if they're identical parallel universes where that shaking process has been done, there's a one in point, that's a lot of O's. You have to look in that many universes to find one molecule of the original substance in that bottle. Okay, we need that. Yeah, keep going. There you go. All right. Now, by comparison, again, most of what's in there is sugar. The active, if you want 5 pounds of pure sugar at Walmart, it's $3. This is the most expensive sugar to price ratio I've ever paid for anything. Okay? Even fine Swiss chocolate is better than this. Right? Here's the container. Okay, whoever's holding it can verify. There's got coffee at Kuda, which is caffeine at 200C. Okay. All right. So, would you please open the break the seal and open the bottle?
We already did that.
Right. Unbroken seal. So I didn't fill it with Tic Tacs or anything like that.
We've got to get this open, and then there's a little piece of plastic in there that dispenses one pill at a time. You want to take the bottle, or
I'll take the bottle.
Okay.
Oh,
I'm going to take one pill.
Okay, he's taking one pill, and please, somebody, a shell in the front, please verify.
Yeah, can't even get one out.
No? And get scissors? the heavy weaponry. Okay. Right. Now, while he's doing this, I want to say that there have been well over 100 studies of the effectiveness of homeopathic medications in curing the things that they claim to cure. And when they use double-blind, randomized, controlled trials, so nobody knows what they're giving, the patients don't know what they're receiving, and it's being compared to placebo, or an actual medicine that cures the underlying disease, if it can be cured, it isn't just an anxious disorder, no effect whatsoever. Not any worse than placebo. No, no, not any better than placebo. Basically, homeopathy and placebo are synonyms, according to over 100 studies of this stuff. Okay?
All right, so here's the attempt to overdose. Professor Sakula is going to take 99 pills. I'm gonna make one pill, because we don't know how to overdose on this stuff.
Right, like, less if you drink more.
The more you dilute it, the more powerful it gets. So there's the one pill. I'm going to make it.
Get that one?
Oh, no. Oh, no, I got to have my OB.
Oh, no. Yeah. All right, we'll just go with this. I don't want the one on the floor. So, all right, here we go. Ready?
I'm going to remove mine from my tongue. So I got to mind you those. By the way, don't do this yourself. You know, we would not do this unless we were absolutely 100% sure there is no medicine in the medicine. Those really are totally their soul is medicine. There's nothing harmful in there. In fact, there's
I'm going to do my dentist after this.
There's a 1 in 320. There's a 1 in 10 of the 320 chance that you got even a single molecule. And if you did, if Professor Sakula won the lottery and he got one molecule of the active ingredient, what's the active ingredient in these homeopathic sleeping pills?
Caffeine. Like, ask me how many cups of coffee I had this morning. Come on, ask. Okay. Now, this is supposed to help me sleep, and this is the best one of all. All right. So this is another bottle of homeopathic sleep aid.
This is a different company.
Different company, yeah.
In a loud voice, okay, project to the back of the room, read what it says in yellow print right there. These are sleeping pills.
Non-drowsy formula, non-habit formula.
Non-drowsy formula. Sleeping pills. Guaranteed not to make you drowsy.
Huh?
What?
Good. So let me close in the last few minutes with some reflections on what we've just done. First of all, I would welcome anybody who wants to come by my office before 4 o'clock today and verify that I'm awake. Okay. You're welcome to do that. People who peddle homeopathy as a form of legitimate medicine on par with conventional medicine based on the germ theory of disease, okay? They make claims like all natural, non-habit forming. And in light of the science, okay, if we look at dilution and our understanding of chemistry and atoms and things like that, which has been tested for over 100 years very well, these claims aren't that true. They are probably all natural in that they come from nature somehow. We're all part of nature, so that's not a lie. And they are non-habit forming, but that's because they contain no actual active ingredient that could cause you to form a habit in the first place. Now, one has to qualify that. By the way, also makes an ineffective remedy for medicine, okay? The placebo effect, however, is real, okay? You can go ahead and take this up on your own. Some of you may have experienced it or tried to experience it. Here's the problem. If homeopathic remedies induce a placebo effect and they make a patient feel better, or cause them to feel faster, okay, or maybe they're just going to get better anyway, right? Shouldn't doctors be allowed to recommend them, and shouldn't people be allowed to buy them, okay? Because it makes people feel better. But if you're not using it as a diagnostic tool, that's not really ethical. It's not ethical to charge somebody for a visit from a doctor, and they say, this is the medicine, the only medicine I have, the only medicine you need, the only medicine I'm going to give you, and it's a sugar pill, and then you die. Now, if they were using it as a diagnostic tool, that would be fine, but that's not what homeopathic doctors are doing. They're using it as a cure. It's not a diagnostic tool. That's an ethical line, okay? There's a gray area in there someplace, but you're well outside the ethical boundary if that's how you're behaving.
And why you're taking this and not taking
that. And why you're taking that, you're not actually taking the medicine you probably need, okay? There's also the nocebo effect. Nocebo is Latin for I will harm. Because people who take a drug that they don't know is a sugar pill, and they think it may be habit forming, when they're withdrawn from the drug, they can go through withdrawal symptoms. Dizziness, headaches, vomiting, nausea, lethargy, all the stuff that's associated with rehabilitation and drug withdrawal, okay? Cramps, sleeplessness, all that good stuff. That's been documented. Again, same kinds of studies you can do for placebo, you can do for nocebo and see if people have withdrawal effects, getting drunk from something that's non-alcoholic. So in the light of the nocebo effect, are homeopathic remedies really guaranteed safe and not addicting? No, because some fraction of the people that get off them will think that they're supposed to withdraw, and they will, okay? So I want you to think about that very carefully the next time somebody offers you a homeopathic remedy for something. I myself once used one for rosacea, because I have rosacea on my face. I didn't know what homeopathy was at the time. I was just happy there was an over-the-counter treatment for my condition that didn't involve me as a grad student paying money, okay, but it's still $10 a bottle for that stuff. I wasted money on that, and I didn't know it at the time. So So anyone can fall for this, and a little knowledge goes a long way when assessing the medical outcomes of a real treatment. Okay? Have a good weekend.
Oh, yeah. Stealth, homeopathic medicine. They're not in really pill form like Zicam.
Zicam, and the one I found was actually at Target next to legitimate health and beauty products. Okay.
Yeah. Read the label.
Read the label.